Good evening, everybody. My name is Harvey Jason, and I am a very, very grateful alcoholic. I am only sober today by the grace of my loving and benevolent God, by the steps and the principles, the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the friendship and the example and the inspiration and the support and the genuine love of men and women like you in rooms like this. I am very, very grateful. I want to thank Paul for inviting me to come and speak tonight. I want to thank my dear friend Michael for driving me down here and for his friendship. I have the honor of him calling me sponsor, and you're a very dear friend, Michael. It's great to see Rocky here. Rocky was a stalwart at my home group, which is the Roxbury Men's Stag. And excuse me, and we miss him very, very much. He moved to the desert, and there's a big hole in that stag every Wednesday night. Maureen, it's great to see you. You know, what a privilege it is. We hear it all the time, what a privilege and an honor it is to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It genuinely is. It truly, truly is. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. And that, thank you very, very much. That was inspiring, and I identified so much with you. I want to warmly welcome those of you who felt comfortable standing up and identifying. Welcome. Welcome home. Welcome back. Welcome to a whole new way of life. You know what? Welcome to right here, right now. There's a concept. That's a concept I could never get on with. I mean, for me, it was just, I lived my life basically by two phrases, both of which are absolutely horrible phrases. One is if only, and the other one is what if. You know, I don't know whether anybody else here feels that way or felt that way, but boy, oh boy, if only, I can't go back, and what if hasn't happened yet. It was Winston Churchill, who said, when he was very ill, just before the end of his life, he said that 95% of the things he worried about never, ever happened. So it's a lesson for me, you know, it's a lesson for me. I have learned through Alcoholics Anonymous to not only have faith in God, but to truly have trust in God. And there's a big difference. I was told that difference is like this. If we go to a circus, say, and you see a guy on a high wire riding a bicycle, we all have faith that he's going to ride that bike from one end of that rope to the other. Trust is when we get up and seat ourselves in the basket of that bicycle. It's quite a difference. You know, I was thinking, I stayed a little bit for the young people's meeting, and I heard a guy coming out. He was talking about a court appearance, and I hadn't thought about that for a long time. But there was one occasion when I had a court appearance, and I went in, and the judge, I hadn't thought about this for ages, and the judge looked at me and said, Mr. Jason, you've been brought in here for some really serious, really heavy drinking. And I actually heard myself say, okay, well, let's get started. And it didn't go well for me, not as well as I'd expected. No, this is a novelty too, instead of having a bottle of water, having a very sophisticated glass. It's very nice. You know, most of us know an optimist is somebody who sees the glass as half full, and a pessimist sees the glass as half empty. But the alcoholic sees the glass as completely redundant. Absolutely. I didn't really drink from glasses. No, So listen, so those of you who have more perceptive hearing might realize that I am actually not originally from Cathedral City. It's been a long time since I left my native North Korea. Actually, I'm from London. As many of you might have guessed, I'm from England. And I was born during the war. That's the Second World War. Listen, this is not so funny. True story. I was sharing not that long ago, and there was a lot of young people there, and a boy, maybe 15, 16 years old, came up to me in the thank you line, and he said, wow, WW2. And I said, yes. And he said, it's like the Civil War, right? And I was... another illustrious example of our brilliant educational system. Unbelievable. But it's good to see all those young people. I'm going to share a story with you about young people. There was a husband and wife of a 9-year-old son, and his behavior was very erratic. And one day when the little boy's at school, the mother says to the father that she thinks the boy's been drinking. And they go into his room and they start looking through his drawers. They don't find anything. And then the mother gets down on her knees and she looks under the bed. And to her horror, she pulls out an empty fifth of vodka. And she's astonished. She looks at the husband. She says, Mike, look at this. And then she goes under again and pulls out yet another empty bottle. And she can't believe it. And then she goes on and she pulls out a pile of the most horrible, grotesque S&M magazines with chains and whips. She looks at the husband. She said, my God, she said, he's 9 years old. What are we going to do with him? And the husband thinks for a minute. He says, well, we're certainly not going to spank him. Sorry. I digress. Anyway, fact is, I don't mean to digress, but I can't resist it. So, I was born during the war. You know, it dawned on me, as we all know, of course, alcoholism is a non-discriminatory disease. It crosses all borders. It crosses socioeconomic lines. It crosses sexual preferences. It crosses races and colors and everything else and religions. And I realize one doesn't have to be, you know, come from a deprived childhood or be beaten or abused to be an alcoholic. My childhood was absolutely idyllic. I'm an only child. It couldn't have been more beautiful. It was a fabulous, fabulous childhood. I grew up in a traditional, sophisticated Jewish home. I love my Judaism. I cherish my Judaism. And to me, the root of Judaism and the root of Alcoholics Anonymous are the same four words. Do the right thing. It's as simple as that. Do the right thing. I grew up, my father had great humor, and we got along absolutely wonderfully. My mother was the love of my life. My mother was a wonderfully sophisticated, artistic woman who instilled in me a love of all things that were right and moral and good. She was a giver. All her life, she was a giver. She loved the arts. She had me reading poetry. She read me literature from an early age. And she was just the most wonderful, wonderful person, filled with love, radiant love. You know, we hear a lot about people who come in a room and light up the room. She truly did. And as luck or fate or whatever would have it, I disregarded all of that, and I went on my own path. Our house got blown up by the V2 rockets, which is not the reason that I became an alcoholic. I was an infant. As a matter of fact, the V2 rocket was designed by a Nazi scientist called Wernher von Braun. And Wernher von Braun wrote an autobiography. I saw it not long ago at an airport, paperback, and it's called I Aim at the Stars. And my first thought when I saw that title was that it needed a subtitle. It needed to be called I Aim at the Stars, but Sometimes I Hit London. Anyway, my first addiction, as it happens, was to love, to being loved. You know, I wanted to be loved, I wanted to be cherished. And it came from my mother, because I was loved and cherished. My earliest recollection, and this all came about my first fourth step, my earliest recollection, I was 18 months old. It's a very early memory. And I was in the bathroom of our house in London. There was a rocking chair. And my mother had given me a bath, and she had wrapped me in this long, you know, fluffy, full towel. And her arms around me, with that towel and the humidity in the room, I can relive it. I felt so protected, so adored, so safe and so cherished that it's a memory that will never, I think, ever leave me. And that's my very first memory about being loved. Right after that, the children in London, in England, particularly in London, the major cities, because of the bombing, the Blitz, we were evacuated to the country. And I was in the first shipment of boys, of children, to be sent out to this boarding school in the country. And I was one of six boys. It had previously been an all-girls school. And so we were the first boys. I was about, three and a half years old. And it was a dormitory style, you know, you slept in the bunks and so forth. But every night, the older girls would come in to the bunks where I was, and they would take me out of the bunk, and they would hold me, and they would cuddle me and caress me, and they would pass me from girl to girl to girl. This is a fantasy I've been chasing all my life. But yet again, you see, it was the idea of just of being so loved, being so loved. Well, you know, years later when I went out into the world didn't treat me the way my mum treated me. You know, so either there was something wrong with the world and I had to rectify it. Well, this is all obviously subconscious reasoning and it's all, you know, retrospective thinking. But so what I did, because I desperately needed your love, you know, and I wasn't tall and I wasn't handsome and I wasn't athletic. And so what that forced me to do, obviously, was to pretend, you know, to put on different masks and be different with you and you and you. Anything that would get me the attention, which was ultimately get you to love me. Well, the problem there is that, and I know it happens to many of us, we put on masks, you know, we pretend to be people we're not. And I pretended for years and years and years to be somebody that I simply wasn't. What ultimately occurs in situations like that is I wear a mask long enough that when ultimately that mask gets removed, a hell of a lot of myself gets removed, pulled away with it, and I don't know who I am. But all the time, what's happened is I've been lying to myself. And not only have I been lying to myself, I've been believing my lies. And it's all fraudulent, it's all phony. It's all awful, and it's all destructive, and it's all self-defeating. But I didn't realize that at the time. I will fast forward a little bit. I didn't come to booze until very, very late in my life, until I was in my 20s. I had no reason for it. You know, I didn't think about it. At age 19, I'd already moved. I was in New York. I was pursuing a career that I wanted. I was living with a woman who was a little bit older than me. I'll give you an example, though, of my alcoholic behavior and thinking before I took that first drink. I was in New York with her, and as I say, I was 19. This was at the time when Castro was coming to power in Cuba. This is gospel truth. I had it in my mind and believed it absolutely that Castro needed my help. I said to her, we're going to have to get down. We had no money. I have to get down to Key West, Florida, and then I'll get a boat, a banana boat or whatever, and I'll get into Havana, and then I'll go up to Oriente Province where Fidel and Che, we're on a first-name basis, you understand that. So we hitchhiked down to Florida, and by the time we got down to Key West, they had closed the harbor. You couldn't get over, couldn't get into Cuba at all. And here, you know, I had had visions of, oh, Fidel and his brother Rel and Che and Harvey, the four of us, you know, riding on horseback and people throwing flowers. This was a major, major thing in my mind, and it couldn't happen. I was defeated, you know, and he won anyway without my help, which was a big blow to my ego. So I was stuck with my girlfriend in Key West, had no money or anything. I did the only sensible thing. I helped her get a job, and then I ultimately came back to New York. Not long after that, I got married. I got married very young. I got married for all the wrong reasons. You know, she was gorgeous and she was sexy and she was rich, and she was well-connected, she was English, and she was, all the wrong reasons, and I led her a merry path. I gave her a terrible, terrible, terrible time. The marriage lasted 2.5 years, and I was away a lot of the time. The last image she ever had of me was lying in a drunken heap between the luggage at JFK at the airport in New York, and her eyes looking down on me with that bewilderment and horror and just a complete confusion. I remember that look, and that was a look that I came to be very familiar with over the years. As a matter of fact, I was terrified when I had to make amends to her. Terrified. And I didn't know where she was. My youngest, I'm now blissfully, happily married, blissfully married. And I have two adult sons who are the apples of my eye. But when I went to make amends to this Helen, who I really, you know, I realized too that love at first sight is really just a side effect of serious drinking. You know, I don't think so, but I think it is. But my younger son found out where Helen was, and she'd gone back to England. And so I had to call her. Now, this was a woman who was incredibly cold. When you saw her, she was so striking looking, and terribly insecure. And she masked that by being very stern and cold as ice. So I dialed the number. My heart was pounding, absolutely pounding. And it rang, and I thought, oh, thank God, there's no one there. And then suddenly the phone gets picked up. And it was, hello? And I said, hello, is this Helen? And she said, who is that? And I said, well, Helen, this is a long time. I said, this is really a voice from the past. I mean, you haven't heard from me for, many, many. She said, if you don't say who this is, I'm putting the phone down. And I said, well, actually, it's Harvey. And there was a very long pause, and she said three words. She said, how utterly bizarre. That's what she said. That is exactly what she said. And I said, look, Helen, I said, it's like 30 years. I said, I've got to tell you, I'm calling because I said, I'm at the point of my life where I'm analyzing what happened. And I said, I've got to tell you, there is no way. What can I possibly do? I treated you so abominably. I was such a wretched husband. She said, no, you were young and passionate. I said, no, I was a horrible, faithless husband. And there was another long pause, and she said, what do you mean faithless? But she stopped me. She was very kind and generous. And she said, no, never mind, don't even tell me. But that started off my amends process. Anyway, I'll get to, as they say, the nitty-gritty. I think for myself, and maybe for other alcoholics, one of the primary ingredients of we who are alcoholics, particularly me, I can only speak for me, is the all-around, total, absolute, unqualified obsession with me. At virtually the exclusion of you, other than how you think about me, the exclusion of your needs, your wants, anything that you want is of no interest to me. I'm only concerned with me. And whatever I have to do to satisfy my needs, I will do, because I am totally insensitive to whatever it is you need. Now, I believe for me, that's alcoholism. That's a primary ingredient. Another one is a total lack of any sort of gratitude. Today, I introduce myself as Harvey Jason. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Now, those two words, grateful alcoholic, are the best two words. They sum me up completely. I am a real alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I drank and I drank and I drank until the booze drank me. And I kept thinking it would be different, whether I came to in jail or on the street or in bed somewhere else, or wherever it was, another country, wherever it was, I came to, and I thought, oh, what have I done? I've done it again and again and again and again. This morning, I woke up in a bed that I knew it was my own bed. I recognized the woman next to me was my wife. I live with such gratitude. My gratitude to God for bringing me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is limitless. It's limitless. And I believe that gratitude is the most important ingredient of happiness. I don't know a happy person who's not grateful. And I don't know a grateful person who's not happy. It is such a marvelous emotion. It's the primary ingredient of happiness. And I believe that gratitude comes when we, when the worst thing, the enemy of gratitude, I think, for me, is expectation. If I feel terrific and I go to bed and I feel really well and I know I'm going to wake up in the morning feeling healthy and well, I wake up, I have no reason to be grateful. But how wonderful it is to express that sense of gratitude. I am such a happy person today. I was never like, this is a complete metamorphosis. I have been changed absolutely by Alcoholics Anonymous. So what happened when I took that first drink? And oh, I loved it. I loved the feeling. I loved it going down. It made me strong. It made me handsome. It made me irresistible. I knew that. You may not have known that, but I knew it to my core. Today, I'm so grateful for all the little things. These clothes have never seen vomit. It's the little things become so important, you know. It is a marvelous, marvelous thing. So I had been so self-obsessed for so many, many years. Here's a story for you. There's a guy that goes to the Olympics, and he's sitting there in London, and he's watching women's gymnastics, and he gets up and stretches, and he's about to sit down again, and somebody yells out, "Larry, Larry!" And he looks around, there's hundreds of thousands, he doesn't know who called him. He starts to sit down again, the same voice, "Larry, Larry, Larry!" And he doesn't know. This goes on 7, 8, 9, 10 times. On the 11th time, when the person yells Larry, the guy gets up, he stretches his arms to the heavens, he says, "For God's sake, my name is not Larry." See? This is an autobiographical story. This is really the story of my life. But you, the 12 steps, the program, and your examples have taught me, you know, I'm far from the be-all and the end-all. You know, the more I think about you, the less I think about me. I love listening to people share from the podium. My home group, which I really could not do without, the Roxbury Wednesday Men's Stag, I love listening to these men share. You know, they share what's happened to them, what's occurred in the transformations through Alcoholics Anonymous, and they show me how to be a man, how to be a real man. You know, to care for people, to be sensitive, to be of service. There's a concept. Service? I've got to worry about what you think and do things for you? Yeah. You know why? It makes me feel terrific, because I'm not thinking about me. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. So I come out to California to do a job of work, and things had been going pretty well in my life, actually, pretty well. And I come out here, but inside me, there was always that terrible sense of inferiority, of genuine insecurity. And it started when I was young. There were, in England, there were clubs that you would join and you'd wear a certain tie to be a part of that club as you were sort of pledging the club. And I was walking down the street one day and I was about 15 years old. And I was wearing the tie very proudly. And three girls were on a corner and they looked at me and one of them said, "What's that thing pledging?" It cut me to the quick. It stayed with me. It stayed with me always. That feeling of hurt, that was like a knife plunged right into me. I never forgot it. And maybe that sense of inferiority, that sense of being less than, started then. I don't know. But nonetheless, I didn't feel I was good enough. I just wasn't enough. I wasn't enough. And I pretended. I pretended, and I masked that insecurity with this masquerade of grandiosity. And that's a deadly combination, insecurity and grandiosity, you know, because it's pretense, it's pretending, it's lying constantly. I had to lie constantly. So I come out here, and I went to a dinner party with a lot of famous people. Now, I love, as you might have guessed, I love telling jokes. And the host there, you know, knew that and invited me. And I'm there with all these people of note, and I'm feeling about this small. I am feeling so small. And the host is looking at me and gesturing, you know, did it? And I was mute. I'm not saying that figuratively. I, I could not make a sound. No sound would come out of my mouth. I felt so intimidated, so small and insignificant, so horrible. I couldn't wait to rush out of there. And I couldn't speak. And I waited the earliest opportunity. I left. And I raced back to the hotel where I was staying. And some friends of the family had owned a company called Bola Wine. And they'd sent me a case of Bola Wine. And I got back to that hotel, and I opened up that first bottle of wine. I didn't bother with a glass. And I chugged down that first bottle of wine. And I started to feel a little bit more relaxed, a little easier. I opened the second bottle of wine, and I finished that one. And then I realized that those people were bloody lucky to have me at that dinner party in the first place. And that really went through my mind. And I thought, you know what? I've cottoned onto something here. All I need is this, and then I'll feel the way I'm supposed to feel, the way I'm destined to feel. And then I didn't bother with wine anymore, and then it was vodka was my drink of choice. And then I drank, and as I say, I drank constantly. And the things that happened to me were so demeaning and so horrendous and so awful. I remember, I was so pretentious, I was so awfully pretentious. I remember once, geez, I haven't thought about this for a long time. I came to downtown L.A. in a the drunk tank, and they were so pretentious. They were filing us in for breakfast, and in a single file. And I'm there trudging along wondering, what the hell, how did I get here? Why did this happen to me? And again, and I'm wandering down there. And the steam table, I didn't like what was on the eggs. And it was like I was at the polo lounge. You know, I heard myself say to the guy, excuse me, would you be so kind? And hear guys like, what, move on, God damn it! I thought, oh my God. But the pretentiousness was always with me, you know, absolutely pretentious. Anyway, I had the opportunities to really travel all over the world at somebody else's expense, at my employer's expense. And you know what? Rather than say, oh, I'm so excited to see the Orient or Australia or Europe or whatever, the first thing that would come to my mind when I got a chance to go overseas was, oh, now I can drink without Pamela, without my wife looking over my shoulder. You know, now I can drink the way I want to drink. And that's a horrible thing. It's such a waste. It's not only a waste of time, and the older I get, I realize time is such a marvelous thing, and it goes so quickly, so quickly, so quickly. And everything I do every day has to be, to me, important, because I'm spending a day of my life on it. A day of my life. So I couldn't stop drinking, and it dawned on me that I'll never, ever be able to stop drinking. That alcohol is going to be with me forever. Now, meanwhile, I got married to a most wonderful, wonderful woman. Just the ideal wife. We met in a business situation, and we have been married for 41 years. And she stayed with me. She belonged to Al-Anon. And I got to tell you, I love being married to a woman in Al-Anon. For, among other reasons, I never, ever again have to take my own inventory. We have two wonderful sons. They're adult sons that are absolutely great. And, you know, we have such tremendous, tremendous times together. But when I was drinking, it wasn't so good. And my boys were small. And, you know, we tell these stories, I think all of us, and some of them are amusing. But with every amusing story, really and truly, there's a knife plunged through somebody's heart. And I plunged a lot of knives through the hearts of a lot of people that I loved. And I have a study at home, and it's a book-lined study. It had always been an ambition of mine to open a really first-class, first-edition collectible literature bookshop. Always, it's been in my mind for years. Anyway, so I got books, and I used to hide my bottles behind the books, you know. But I'd go in the study every night, go in there before dinner, and I would take my bottles out, then I'd drink myself into a stupor. And then I'd come out, I'd sit at the table, and my sons, who were small, and my wife, never knew who was going to come out of that study. And while I was never, ever, ever physically abusive, never in my life, I was verbally abusive. And I said things to my loved ones that I'd give anything to take back. Anything to take those things back. But like my mom used to say, words are like birds, they fly away. You can't be sorry for what you don't say. Restraint of pen and tongue. I didn't have it then, and I try to have it now. But I would come out, and then I'd go back after dinner, and I would drink more. And the times that I collapsed on the floor, and I'd come to in the morning with that vile, stinking vodka coming out of my pores, and my hand shaking like mad, and my head throbbing, that ice-cold sweat dripping down me, and think, I've done it again. And I have a big Bible in my study. And every once in a while, I'd go to that Bible, and I'd put my hand on that Bible in the morning, and I'd swear to God that I was not going to drink that day, and I wouldn't drink that day. And then the next day, I'd go in there, and I'd approach the Bible, and then I'd say, I don't have to take this pledge today. I know I'm not going to drink today. Right back again, collapsed, wherever it was, collapsed again. And I'd go in there at night, and the feelings of loneliness. I had nothing in the world to be lonely about or despondent about or depressed about, but I was so obsessed and absorbed in myself. I was so miserable, and I suppose I drank for the reason that many of us drink, because some aspect of our life, something, maybe me or parts of my life, whatever it is, I didn't have, I don't have, I want, I might not get, I did get, but all about me. And by pouring as much vodka down my throat as possible, the things that are important to me are no longer so important. The things I worry about, I don't worry about anymore. And in the morning I don't wake up, and everything is exactly the same. I've been lying to myself. The booze has lied to me, and I believed the booze. Again, I believed it, and the booze lied to me again, and again I believed it, and a little bit more of my soul has been chipped away. A little bit more of my soul has gone. And I thought, I'll never be able to get over this. I need the booze like I need to breathe. This will never, ever, ever be taken away from me. And I'll tell you what happened. What happened was, I came to one morning. It was precisely 5,515 days ago today. Yeah. And those of you who don't have a calculator on your laps at the moment, I have, by the grace of God, just over 15 years of sobriety. So I... that's generous of you. The applause is to you. The applause is to him. The applause is to the book. And the steps, and the principles, and the program. Thank you. So I come to again, and I'm in terrible, terrible shape. And I had just written a film script where the protagonist was a recovering alcoholic. And I called, I waited, this is about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I waited till a sensible time, and then I called my agent, whose house that sophisticated party was at, and who was, in fact, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those of you, there may be people here who know him, he was quite well known in the program. His name was Robert Lippman, Bobby Lippman. May he rest in peace. He had terrible, terrible trouble staying sober, but he died sober. And as my friend Rocky says, he beat the disease. It's the only way we beat the disease is to die sober, and he died sober. But he helped hundreds of people. And I called Bobby, and I said, Bobby, listen, it dawns on me, I said, that since their studio, they're paying me to do a polish on this script, I should probably go to one of your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I can get an idea of what, you know, the rooms look like and the people. I believe this, you know. And I went, he said to me, meet me Sunday morning on the corner of Pico and Robertson, and I'll take you to a meeting called the Robertson Originals. And so I met him. This was Saturday morning, the crack of dawn. I met him Sunday. And I see him now standing on the corner, and I cross the street. He gave me a big hug. He said, "Harvey, you don't know how lucky you are not to be an alcoholic like me." I said, "Yeah, I could imagine, you know, yeah." But you see, such a liar was I. This man was my closest friend in the world, and I spoke to him virtually daily, and I was such a liar that I never ever allowed him to know that I was a drunk, at least as much of a drunk as he was. So he takes me to this meeting. I'd never seen anything like it. There were about 200 people, and the chairs, we got there early, and all these people were, they weren't playing, they were happy. They weren't pretending. And there were keys on chairs and items of things on chairs. I'd never seen anything like it. People are drinking coffee and laughing. And then the meeting started, and I sat down. And a woman got up to speak, Molly B. And although she was a woman, I'm a man, and her situations were different, the emotions that this woman expressed were exactly the emotions that I felt. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I was cold as ice, and the tears were streaming down my face. And I listened to her talk, and I thought, my God, that's me. I mean, that's exactly how I feel. The feelings are exactly the same. I couldn't believe it. It was like a thunderclap that had come down and just struck me, whether it was a burning bush or a white light, whatever you call it. It was the most incredible experience. I could never have imagined such a thing happening to me. I listened to her, and at the conclusion of that meeting, I went and I got a big book, and I bought a 12 and 12. And then I went home, and I read the big book. I read from the doctor's opinion, then I realized, that's me. That's me. What an explanation. And I read the first 164 pages of that book. And it made a lot of sense to me. And I thought, you know, this is really me. This is something. This is a whole new life. This could be an entirely new life for me. And I went to a meeting the next day and the next day. And I went to Roxbury. And I got a sponsor. And then we started on those steps. The sponsor was the wrong sponsor for me. The day after the stag, this fellow called me up and he said, you know, I heard you at the meeting last night. I'd gone into the meeting and somebody said, oh, you're new. Before the meeting started, we used to have to line up. And they said, well, they'll call on you, you know. I said, what do you mean they'll call on me? For what? He said, well, they're going to call you up to the podium. I said, to do what? So he said, well, you're going to have to talk. I said, what? He said, you're going to have to share. I said, share? What are you talking about? He said, they call newcomers up to the... I said, no, no, no. So I went into the room and I said, who's in charge of this meeting here? So this guy said, he's leading the meeting. So I went up, I said, hello, my name's Harvey. I said, look, I'm very, very new, so I really would appreciate it if you don't call on me. Thank you. And I went and I sat in the back of the room. The guy gets up, he says, all right, let's hear from newcomer Harvey. And I didn't like that meeting. And I didn't like it for a long time. And in retrospect, I didn't like that meeting because I didn't put my hand out. I sat in the back row. I talked to no one. And I wasn't particularly nice when people talked to me. Today, I couldn't go on without that meeting. That meeting is the cornerstone of my sobriety. The men in that room are like my blood brothers. I went in there not knowing one soul. I know everybody in that room. We have about 220 people in that room every Wednesday night. And these men are such examples to me. They're such examples. They live life the way life is supposed to be lived, with goodness and with sweetness and with a sense of morality and with true sobriety. Sobriety. Sobriety, my God. So I started going to your meetings and I began to love your meetings. I really did. And then 4 months into the program, I had to fly to France, to Paris. And I had never in my life flown sober. Never. And I, armed with the little version of the big book, the little one, I took it on the plane. I sat there shaking, reading the book again. I'd already read it sober. I'm reading the book. And I wanted a drink all the time for these 4 months. And I get to Paris, I get to this big reception, and waiters are going by with the trays of booze and so forth. And as he passed me, I looked up and I realized I didn't want that drink. And I couldn't believe it. The next thought was, I don't need that drink. And I tell you what, I was rooted to the spot. I couldn't believe it. I was mesmerized. I don't know how long I stood there, but I thought, God has relieved me of the obsession to drink. He took it away from me. He relieved me of that obsession. And from that day to this, it is the there doesn't exist. But God did that through this program and through men and women like you. God took it away. And I believed that it would never happen. And it happened. That gave me pause for thought. It gave me such an optimism for life, realizing that God can do and does do anything. But I have to play my part in it. My mother used to say, God helps those who help themselves. You know? So instead of being a taker, as I was all my life, I have now experienced the joy of giving, of being a giver. What joy there is in that, to seeing the light go under. I sponsor a lot of guys to take these men through the book and see the light go on in their eyes and see the changes in their behavior resultant from the changes in their thinking. It's a miraculous thing. We're all miracles. Everybody in a seat here. The trick is that some of us see the miracle, some of us don't see the miracle. And there's a story about that too. And there's a guy that goes duck hunting. And he takes his dog and his gun, right? And he goes, he's got the dog, and he shoots a duck, and the duck falls into the water. The dog rushes to the water's edge. Then the dog jumps on top of the water, and he walks on the water, gets the duck, walks on the water, comes back, and drops it at his master's feet. Well, the guy can't believe his eyes. So he shoots again, and again, the same thing happens. The dog's walking on the water. So the man sees a stranger shooting. He calls the stranger. He says, excuse me, would you come over here? Just watch my dog for a minute. Stranger comes over. The guy shoots. Duck drop. The dog rush. Again, the dog walks on the water and walks on the water back. So the man says to the stranger, did you notice anything unusual just now? And the stranger thinks for a minute. He says, yeah, you know what? I did. Your dog can't swim. Some of us see the miracle. Some of us don't see the miracle. But if, you know, if we realize that you know, obviously we're all the same here. If we think that God, that we will never stop drinking, using or whatever, and suddenly it happens, that's God. That's God, you know. And I know we all have different conceptions of God or whatever, but there is one God, and God is good. But we have to have... I have to have not only the faith, but the trust, the real genuine trust. Because if I don't believe that something is going to happen, then I am not going to give it 100%. You know, am I right? I'm not going to give it 100%. If I believe that this program will work, boy, I will work it. I will work it. And to me, when I hear people say, I just use the word work it. To me, it's not work. I love it. I love going through the book. You know, everything about this way of life is so glorious. It's glorious. It's taught me how to tell the truth. You've taught me that truth was not something that came naturally to me. But I'm sorry, but I'm going to digress, tell you another story about truth, about people in this program. There's a couple that were celebrating their 20th wedding anniversary, both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they both went for their anniversary, and they got a hotel room, and they had a lovely dinner, and they were getting ready for bed. And the husband said to the wife, I adore you, and we've been married so long, and we're both faithful, dedicated members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell me the truth. Was there ever a time in all these years when you were unfaithful to me? And the wife hesitated a millisecond too long. And he said, my God, you were. You cheated on me. And she said, well, let me explain. She said, I don't want to. How many times? She said, look, there were three. He said, three times? She said, let me explain. When we were first married and you opened the business, and immediately the business went broke and they were going to foreclose on the house. And I went to see the bank manager. And after that, we never had any problems with foreclosure. So he said, so in other words, then you did it for, wait a minute, then what was the second time? She said, well, because of all that stress, you had the first of your heart attacks. Then after 3 heart attacks, you needed the open heart surgery, the quadruple bypass, and you had it. And then the surgeon's bills started to come in. I mean, they were astronomical. And then one day I went to see the surgeon. We had no more bills coming. He said, then you actually saved my... Wait a minute, then what was the third time? She said, well, because of all your medical problems, you had to exercise. So you took up golf, and you played golf every single day. And then you joined the golf club, kept playing, and then one day you were running for the presidency of the golf club. And all you needed to win were another 74 votes. That's rigorous honesty. But that rigorous honest. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I believe so much in the power of prayer and in the power of meditation. But prayer, when I talk to God, that's called prayer. If I hear God talk back to me, that's called schizophrenia. So I don't worry about that. But the fact is that I speak to God. It takes me a long time. Every morning, it takes me about 40 minutes to say my prayer. I say my prayers in Hebrew and in English because I know God is at least bilingual. So I really do. It takes me 40 minutes in the morning, and then I will pray in my own way regularly throughout the day, and then at night I will thank God, and I will thank God specifically. I like to be specific. I know God hears me, but I need to hear all the things for which I'm grateful. And so I express them. You know, I'm grateful for my God, for my sobriety, for the people who surround me, for the love of my wife, for the wonderful, wonderful sons I have, for the roof over my head, for all of this. You know, it was a terrible thing when you live with someone and you don't want them to know how much you drink. It's very, very difficult to hide the bottles. And I spent years and years hiding them. There was a period at one point, all my books used to be taken out because my wife, Pamela, used to go in there looking, finding the bottles, the empty bottles. There was a period where in my insanity, I went and bought reams of gift wrap paper. I would gift wrap empty liquor bottles, stick bows on them with ribbon, I mean, really pretty. I'd get a big, huge bag of them from the market, and I'd go around the neighborhood throwing these presents on people's lawns, empty liquor bottles wrapped up beautifully like Christmas presents. You know? So at one point, my study used to be a maid's room and bath, and we didn't need the bath, so we had the woodworker who did the study cover up the tub with a heavy slab of oak. Well, one day I was in there, and I suddenly thought, wait a minute, if I could pry up the top of that oak bathtub, I have a whole tub to hide my empty bottles. She'll never find them in here. So I waited till they were out of the house. I got my toolbox out. It took me, I'm Jewish, it's very difficult for me to do it. I got this big thing up and I had a virgin tub. I was so proud. I was so pleased with myself. It was like I deserved a Pulitzer Prize, this empty bathtub. So every day, I'd be putting the empties in the tub. Pamela was going around the house, crazed, couldn't find the bottles, couldn't find the empties. And I got a sadistic pleasure out of that. So then one day, I was coming home, and I put the key in the front door, and the door just opened. And my father and Pamela were standing there looking very serious. And my kids had medical problems. And I said, what's the matter? And they just said, oh. So I thought, what the hell is this? We start walking through the house. It didn't dawn on me. As we started moving towards the back, I thought, oh, no. Oh, no, this couldn't possibly happen. We get into the study. The top is up. And that bathtub is filled to the brim, to the top, with empty quarts and fifths and half gallons and miniatures and pints and half pints to the top, like a filled with bottles. Very quietly, my father points to that and he says, what's this? How do you answer something like that? You know, why would the neighbors come and do something like this to me? Thank God I don't have to live like that anymore. But I was thinking recently, you know, I don't even know. I have no recollection of emptying that tub. None at all. So for all I know, they might be there. But the contrast in my life today is so enormous. The impact that Alcoholics Anonymous has made is just absolutely phenomenal. And as I say, it is in every sense of the word, semantically, literally, miraculous. It's miraculous. What I have been given, this gift. It's a life. My God, it's so brilliant. It's so pure. It's so glorious. I never have bad days. Isn't that something? I mean, there are moments that are not as good as other moments. But to have a whole bad day, how can I have a bad day? It's impossible. I just think of all the things I have to be grateful for. God has brought me this, the wonderful dream that I'd had all these years of opening a bookshop. My younger son and I, 1 year after God brought me into these rooms, my son Louis and I opened this bookshop. We opened a first edition bookshop on Sunset Strip, which because of his Al-Anon program and Alcoholics Anonymous and all that you teach me, is now called one of the 10 most important first edition shops in the United States. That's no credit. I mean, really, I'd love to say it's credit to us. It isn't. It's the way we live our lives, the way we've been taught to live our lives. And to go into this shop every day, work with my son, that tranquility, that being surrounded, you know, by the signed Dickens and the Hemingway and the Ford, all the class. It's so serene. It's so peaceful. And there on the top shelf of one of our showcases is My Pride and Joy. It's a big red book, which is the first printing of the first edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that book is not for sale. It's my copy. But what invariably happens is every once in a while, somebody will come in, and they'll be talking, and they'll be looking at something, and then they'll suddenly, an arm will go up, and they'll say to me, when I see that, I know exactly what they're going to say, and I make them say it. And I say, yes? And they say, is that book up there, the red one, is that the first edition of the Alcoholics Anonymous book? And I say, it is the first printing of the first edition of the Big Book. Are you by any chance in the program? And usually there's a little tiny pause, and they say, yes. And I say, good, me too. And I give them a big hug, and we talk, and we share, and it's sensational. It's absolutely, life couldn't be better, you know, and I couldn't express the amount of gratitude I feel. It is wonderful. It is just absolutely wonderful. And you can have this, and you can have this, and you can have this. You people who are new, it's possible and it's probable. And all you have to do is show up and believe. Believe that it's possible. What I say to people who are tempted to pick up a drink is this. You pick up a drink, and what you're doing is you're spitting in the face of God. You're spitting right in God's face. Because in essence, what you're saying to God is what you give me in this glorious world with all the endless possibilities, not enough for me. I want more. I want more. I want more. But believe it. Not only is there a skull and crossbones on that bottle, but you're spitting right in God's face. I don't want to spit in God's face. I don't want to ever, ever do anything except be so limitlessly grateful to God for all of you, for this life. And I'll close with a couple of lines that I love, and that I say, I thank thee, dear God, for another sober day and a chance to live in a decent way, to experience the true joy of living and the happiness that comes from giving. Thank you all so much, and God bless us all.